welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Search for Captain Slocum by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on chapter 19, and this is the 15th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out The Mariner Podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, The Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 19. With such as love sailing, Mother Wit is the best teacher after experience. With the voyage almost 2 years behind him, Slocum still had nothing to do, no place to go. He wanted to exhibit the spray and himself at the Universal Exhibition in Paris in 1900, and his century friend, Boulle, tried to make arrangements. The sloop, however, was passed up in favour of something of historic interest, a Viking ship, not a real one, of course, but a model. By now, Slocum found it perfectly natural that the Spray, which had sailed with simply one Yank on board 10 times the distance ever claimed for the Vikings, should be rejected. "The event of her career is too new," was his unhappy comment to Boulle. Suddenly, he was planning a trip to Iceland. It was something to do, and it was, perhaps, a chivalrous gesture in Mabel's direction. At almost the same time, he was discussing a project for underwater exploration. He hoped S.P. Langley would soon launch a flying ship and applied for position of second mate on it. He did not know which direction to go in, but he was desperate for action. In the winter of 1900, the Spray was again tied up at Erie Basin Dry Dock, South Brooklyn. Garfield was shipkeeper. His father and Hetty were living in rooms in New York. "Father did not come on board the Spray much," Garfield complained. "Did not come to inquire if I needed any food or if he could help me. It was a mystery to me and will be to my dying day." I assume that he and Hetty did not pull on the same rope. Hetty was cool towards me. Father acted as though he wanted to be alone. One day he came and told me that he would cast off and get underway for Buffalo in the spring of 1901. He said the Pan American Exposition would pay him for the privilege of exhibiting the Spray. The captain bought in Kos Kob, Connecticut, a 1.5-horsepower marine engine, the equivalent in power of the smallest present-day outboard motor. Garfield wrote it was the first of its kind. Then he bought a clinker-built lifeboat and had it fitted to the engine, and had Garfield instructed in its operation. Thus Garfield was engineer on the craft, which towed the Spray up the Hudson River to Troy and through the Erie Canal to Buffalo. Slocum could hardly have started before the middle of April. Usually the ice has not melted till that time. The Erie Canal was widened and rebuilt over a slightly different course in 1918, but in the captain's day it had changed very little since its opening in 1825. For her inland voyage, the world-circling Spray had a crew consisting of Slocum, Hetty, and Garfield. "Father," Garfield wrote, "told me to hug the shore, and he steered near the shore because the current running upstream helped. Every night we tied up to whatever we could find." The Hudson, in its lower course, is a tidal river. From New York Bay to Albany, 145 miles away, the fall is only 5 feet. When the Spray arrived there, reporters went aboard. Garfield wrote that at this time his father did not like reporters, in fact, hated publicity. Since his days on the Northern Light almost 20 years earlier, the captain had sat for a good many thumbnail sketches, and though some reports had been careless or slanted to make the nonconformist appear merely queer, American newspaper men, by and large, had not done too badly by Slocum. Furthermore, he had wanted and enjoyed the notice, and indeed, sometimes could hardly have functioned or made a dollar without it. Now, however, the reporting was becoming more flippant and disrespectful. It hurt Slocum's pride and added to the sense of frustration he was feeling. He felt criticised and was unable to cope with the criticism. His handwriting, after 1899, shows him insisting on details, patching up tiny places of fading ink as if he could not countenance the slightest failure. There was a deepening of the changes already in motion. At Troy, 6 miles further up the river, the two masts were taken out and lashed on deck. On entering the Erie Canal, Slocum remarked to Garfield, "This is the roughest water I ever sailed on." Garfield added that when they reached Buffalo, all hands were well, no one was seasick. He said that the spray attracted a great deal of notice both along the way and when placed on exhibition. The Pan American Exposition opened 1st of May and ran till 2nd of November. Whatever the real purpose of its promoters, it was advertised as a celebration of progress in the Western Hemisphere. This was the progress-proud 19th century. To find Slocum there, an anachronism in time, seems a truly ironic touch. Few men are more conservative than those who build and sail boats, but the irony was probably lost among the curiosities, oddities, eccentrics, freaks, and advertised artistic and educational features of the sprawling, exuberant, and tasteless show. It was held in Delaware Park, a 365-acre tract, including a 46-acre lake and adjoining a tributary of the Niagara River. To reach the park lake, called Gala Water, the spray had to be hauled out and raised in a sling which the captain devised from a hawser, loaded onto a dray drawn by four horses, with Garfield on board all the while, and finally launched in the lake by means of a cradle Slocum built on the spot. And there she remained 6 months while tourists were urged to shake hands with the gallant captain, a man of stout heart and steady nerve, a veteran of the salt seas, and a man of mighty soul and character. While the captain rode at anchor between the triumphal bridge and the dazzling electric tower with its thousands of lights, 42 Indian tribes were whooping it up in the stadium. Beneath the dome of the Temple of the Music, the band poured out the Latin American rhythms of Victor Herbert's Pan Americana. On the midway, sightseers gaped at fur-clad Eskimos in imitation ice igloos, South Sea Islanders in native dress, South American Hidalgos, hula hoop dancers, large-headed dwarves, the infant incubator, and Chiquita, the human doll. A visit to the spray competed with a trip to the moon, or the streets of Mexico and a spurious bullfighting. The old plantation with banjo strumming singers, the Hawaiian village, the beautiful Orient, the scenic railway, the magic house of mystery, the wild animal show, and Alt Nuremberg. Scenes of the Spanish-American War were reenacted, US cavalry troops reproduced Custer's last charge. There was an Indian who impersonated Geronimo, the Apache chief, and a lady who interpreted Cleopatra. Slocum had only himself and the boat, and Hetty and Garfield to exhibit. He answered the visitors' questions and autographed and sold his books. Sailing Alone, $2. Voyage of the Liberdad, he still had a few copies, $1. And a neat 48-page booklet, Sloop Spray Souvenir, 25 cents. After all, like Buffalo Bill, his fellow exhibitor at the exposition, and other American heroes who had undertaken valid adventures, his defiance was petering out in sideshows. In the Sloop Spray Souvenir, Slocum made use of the sail stripped from the boat when she first nosed down to the Strait of Magellan and into the Pacific, 5 years before. Opposite the title page, he tucked in a piece of the stained canvas. On the title page itself, beneath the title, the captain had printed, arranged and supplied with notes by Henrietta E. Slocum. Using Hetty's name, but his own style, he described the souvenir and himself. A collection of reviews of the Spray's famous voyage around the world, from leading journals, with something tangible of the Spray herself, namely a piece of her original mainsail, which was torn beyond repair in the gale off Cape Horn from the 4th to the 8th of March 1896, a fierce tempest. Admiring friends of the Spray visiting her with jackknives, first and last, be their keen appreciation of souvenirs, suggesting the preparation of this memento. But even now, as he reread and gathered together words of sympathy and praise, he could not forget his detractors and disbelievers, nor disguise the hostility he increasingly felt. Hetty, in the pamphlet, is made to tell how, when he was sailing across the Indian Ocean and for many months was not heard from, some with little faith gave him up for lost, and how, when long after the captain read the premature obituary, he said, "They did not speak of my virtues when they had me on the other shore." This was, of course, a reference to Hetty's relatives, if not to Hetty herself. Then, still attributing the words to his wife's pen, he wrote for Mabel, "It is interesting to know that among Captain Slocum's nearest friends, someone always said, the Spray will come back." Slocum was probably on the exposition grounds when President McKinley was shot on the 6th of September in the ornate Temple of Music. It was there that Theodore Roosevelt took the oath of office. McKinley had signed the Spray's visitors book, Garfield wrote. Pan American tourists, all told, filled 3 volumes. Sometime in the autumn, Slocum left. He sold the lifeboat to a local fisherman, as he had devised for himself a quieter source of power, and besides, Garfield, the engineer, had taken a job. The papers noted the captain's departure. Horse is Captain Slocum's sail, navigator of the Spray weighs anchor and sets off down the raging Erie Canal, is going to be a farmer, hand which held the tiller is soon to hold the plough, satisfied with his exposition experience. With an old workhorse for a sail, the Spray sailed down the Erie Canal yesterday afternoon in the general direction of the Hudson River. Captain Joshua Slocum was standing on the deck, bidding a farewell to Buffalo and all that is left of the exposition. No whistling for a breeze. You see, explained the captain, it don't make much difference which way the wind blows. We get there just the same. No, I didn't have the horse sharp-shod. The canal don't go over many hills between here and the Hudson. About the time the horse will be all in, the good sloop will reach Troy. Then Captain Slocum, thoughtful man that he is, will entice the horse aboard, set real sail and glide down the Hudson and through the Sound as far as Martha's Vineyard. The Spray has lain in the Erie Canal at the foot of Ferry Street since the night that the waiter turned the hose on the crowds at Pabst's on the Midway. The horse that furnished the motive power to run the sloop down the canal will furnish the power to run a plough on the captain's farm in Martha's Vineyard. The hand that steered the tiller of the Spray will steer the plough. The voice that refused to allow a woman to accompany him across the Atlantic will say, "Gee up" to the horse when it comes ploughing time. Yes, concluded he, as the sloop pulled away from Ferry Street, I got 2/3 of the money owed me by the exposition company. I met fine people, was treated well, and, considering everything, am satisfied. Garfield's last word on the Pan American was, I wonder how father steered the horse. He did not write me to tell me about his return trip. Chapter 20. Beware of reefs, day or night, or, remaining on the land, be wary still. With earnings from the exposition, lecturing, and royalties from his book, Slocum was now able to buy what he thought he wanted, certainly what Hetty wanted, a home. Nearly 10 years earlier, at the end of the voyage of the destroyer, when the promised Brazilian pay seemed within his grasp, he wrote, I begin to think of the little farm which so many years ago I promised myself. I say now, I could almost hear the potatoes growing, but not quite. Garfield wrote that his father said that if he settled down, it would be in the Hawaiian Islands, for he liked the climate. But when the time came, he chose instead a New England island, Martha's Vineyard, where some of his sisters and a brother lived, and where he was not altogether a stranger. From Buffalo, Hetty went straight to relatives in East Boston. The captain and the Spray took their time. I am prospering fairly well. I hope all my friends are enjoying fair wind, he wrote Boole, 3rd of February 1902, from Washington, D.C., which was not exactly en route between Buffalo and Massachusetts. On the 1st of March, the Vineyard Gazette reported, Captain Slocum, who has the fame of going around the world in a sailboat, has purchased the residence and lot firmly owned by the late John Manta, also another land of Samuel E. West, so as to have enough for a small farm. The cost of the property was $305. The village of West Tisbury, where the captain settled, is about in the centre of Martha's Vineyard, away from the sight and sound of the ocean. In Slocum's day, it still was favoured by whalemen, trying to forget the 30- and 40-month voyages. Farthest inland of any of the island's settled places, it is generally level, and its soil adapted to farming. Slocum's little house on the Edgartown Road, still sturdily standing, still shingled with the shingles he is said to have brought across Buzzard's Bay in the sloop, is next door to the big house where Captain James Cleveland, one of the vineyard's prominent whalers, lived. For a while the captains lived side by side. A Cleveland grandchild wrote, Captain Slocum lived in a very old, small Cape Cod house and added a section without regard to architectural unity, put a curving Japanese temple type of roof over the front, and beside the door the usual shells and chunks of coral of the seafaring man. My grandfather used to entertain a great many interesting men in the kitchen. I remember his bringing Captain Slocum into the front part of the house and my aunt greeting him and saying to me, This is Captain Slocum, who sailed around the world in the sloop Spray. As I remember, he was a small, wiry man, bald with a pointed beard and very bright, small, piercing dark eyes. Mrs. Slocum used to stay with us occasionally. She was quite firm in her determination never to go to sea with her husband again. Garfield wrote that his father bought the house because he liked the large timbers and the knees, which looked like the hold of a ship. So far as the farm was concerned, he planned to raise fruit trees. The captain began his new work with gusto. Farming must have brought to mind his earliest days. He was working in his garden when Clifton Johnson came over from Hadley to photograph and interview him. Johnson was an illustrator and author who believed that in Slocum he had discovered a great contemporary. It had been a long time since a thoughtful man had shown any interest in him, and Slocum responded warmly. Before the two men met, they exchanged letters. "Then you have heard of the Old Spray and sailing alone," Slocum wrote. "She is a knowing old boat, and it's great fun sailing her. Would you like to take a spin in her?" The captain wrote a second time. "Rudder Ranch, West Tisbury, Massachusetts, September 21st, 1902. We will be able to put you up at our old ranch and be glad of the opportunity to do so if you will take pot luck with us." Author's note: Rudder Ranch, as an address, is one of the captain's jokes. The true name he gave the place was Fag End, the useless end of a piece of line at sea, so Hetty told the present writer. Slocum continues, "My son Victor, just home from a whaling voyage, is helping me repair the shack. He is quite a sailor. Although we may fit the Spray on a voyage when you come, please keep the lecture Enterprise in view." After his visit, Johnson wrote up Slocum for Outing magazine. For the biographical part of his article, he had to depend on the captain, and so he got scant pickings. No dates, few names or places, not a word of Virginia, dead now 18 years. But when it came to the testimony of his eyes, Johnson was able to do better. "The Spray, as I first saw her," he wrote, "lay gently rocking in a little cove on the Massachusetts coast near Woods Hole. There were other vessels about. The Spray could not compete with them in grace and style, yet she had an attractive air of domesticity and was evidently built for a sea home suited to all seasons and all waters and not simply adapted to fair summer weather along shore. It was a pleasure to set foot on her and note her snug appointments. It was a pleasure to eat with Captain Slocum a rough and ready lunch that he deftly prepared in the little galley, and it was a pleasure, when night came, to bunk under a deck awning and sleep on board. But best of all was a sail the next morning in the Old Spray, as her owner affectionately calls her, from the mainland across to Martha's Vineyard." His house is one of the most ancient on the island, an oak-ribbed arc of a dwelling with warped floors and tiny window panes and open fireplaces. Its aspect is at present rather forlorn and naked, but the captain knows how to wield the hammer and the saw and will soon make it snug. In a single season, he has become an enthusiastic agriculturalist, is proud of his flourishing garden, and would like to own and make fruitful all the land round about. Martha's Vineyard looks to him like Eden, and it is likely the sea will know him no more. Johnson saw Slocum in the first fine flush of farming. Garfield wrote that though he himself spent 3 years on the island, he did not help his father, and that all he recalls of the captain's agricultural efforts was the setting out of fruit trees. The captain's brother, Ornan, helped, although, according to a relative, he was not a strong man, and the captain had small patience with him. Despite constant bickering, they worked together till the day when Ornan, while cultivating, ran, or let the horse run, against the trees. This barked them up and enraged the captain. He swore that Ornan was trying to wreck his beautiful young trees out of sheer cussedness. Ornan left, and he and the captain did not see each other again for some time. Then one day they met on a narrow path. They were ready to pass, eyes straight ahead, when Ornan thought what a couple of fools they had been. So he gave his brother the shoulder and, spinning him halfway round, shouted with a grin, "Good morning, Captain!" And so the incident ended happily enough, but, as a relative commented, Ornan did not play Cincinnatus with Captain Slocum again. In the spring of 1903, the Vineyard Gazette reported that Slocum, in addition to his homestead, had purchased a large woodlot and about 160 acres of cleared ground. As is often the way with an enterprising but untried farmer, he tried to grow something new, in this case hops. Mrs. Donald Campbell of West Tisbury recalled picking hops for the captain when she was a girl, but only once, for he did not repeat the experiment. He was, she added, tall, spare, courteous and reserved. Reports had it that the barn on the old Pease Place was filled not with crops, but with shells, coral, starfish, sea fans, enormous white clam shells with fluted edges, odd scallop shells and others, brought home to give away, sell or as ballast. In his second summer on the farm, instead of making hay, Slocum went sailing on Buzzards Bay and Vineyard and Nantucket Sounds. A certain Edwin Robinson of Wentworth, New Hampshire, wrote that he saw the spray hauled out at Onset, Massachusetts, in the summer of 1903, and that he saw her again that summer at Cottage City and rowed over to her. Captain Slocum was giving a young man a lecture on the proper way to come alongside an anchored boat without smashing up things. The captain said business of selling shells was slowed, but that he was going to stay around for a few days longer anyhow. Dr. Charlotte Richmond of Amherst, Massachusetts, saw the captain in the summer of 1903. Captain Slocum spent many weeks at Marion, and my mother used to send me out in the rowboat with food supplies for him. In time, I grew to regard him almost as a good uncle, a teller of wonderful tales, and a giver of many interesting small gifts, she wrote. When harvest time came, Slocum, instead of drying beans at home, was hooking a shark at the Sipican Casino at Marion, greatly to the relief of the bathers, the Vineyard Gazette reported. By 1902, paying lectures had become few and far between. Of course, he could always give away a benefit lecture, as he did in his newly adopted town in a rugged old hall. On the 20th of November, the West Tisbury correspondent exhorted Gazette readers, "Do not forget the lecture at Agricultural Hall on Thursday evening by Captain Slocum entitled, A Tour Around the World. A rare treat is in store for our people." Perhaps Slocum gave them, as he penned on one of his circulars, 100 slides of places visited and of peoples met with on the voyage, savage and otherwise. Johnson got his brother Henry of Johnson's Bookstore, Springfield, Massachusetts, to act as the captain's lecture agent. In December, Slocum lectured in Springfield, but the Slocum style of lecture had about run its course. Earlier, for a short time, he had been booked by the Lyceum Bureau of New York, and the leading impresario of the day, Major James B. Pond of 1838 to 1903. For 25 years, Pond had handled all the big names, from Mark Twain, Cable and Whitman, to Stanley, Perry, Henry Ward Beecher, and William Dean Howells. In his entertaining and enlightening book, Eccentricities of Genius, the Major explained that Slocum was born too late. Pond's own eccentricity was exaggeration, but his description of the captain's predicament and, incidentally, his own, seemed heartfelt enough. Author's note. Correspondence between Mark Twain to William Dean Howells, 25th of January, 1900. If you got half as much as Pond prophesied, be content and praise God. It has not happened to another. But I am sorry he didn't go with you, for it is marvellous to hear him yarn. His mill is never idle. Pond wrote of Slocum, "Captain Joshua Slocum, who conceived the idea that he could sail around the world, is about the newest and most remarkable of the small list of hazardous adventurers who have done something that no other man has succeeded in accomplishing, and thereby acquired worldwide fame. What is most remarkable of all is that Captain Slocum is able to write and describe the incidents of the entire voyage and his wonderful experiences in a manner so graphic and simple that it absolutely charms and fascinates his hearers as few ever did or ever could do. It is wonderful to listen to the descriptions of some of his hairbreadth escapes and to hear him answer as quick as a flash questions of every conceivable sort put to him by expert seafaring auditors. I have listened for hours to these seeming tournaments in navigator's skill, and never yet did the captain hesitate for an instant for a reply that went straight to the mark like a bullet. Had all this occurred 20 years ago, it would have meant a fortune for Captain Slocum and a stimulant for the Lyceum such as it is impossible to secure under present conditions. Because why, you ask? Because under the present conditions, lecture courses are forced upon the communities by agents representing various lecture bureaus who round up a committee of enterprising citizens who want to do something for the town and persuade them to go on a guarantee fund to secure a course of lectures and entertainments. So when the newspapers published the accounts of such heroic adventurers as Captain Slocum, and a circular is sent out announcing his intention to relate from the lecture platform for the enlightenment of the public the story of his adventures, this local guarantee committee informs the captain that they already have a course of lectures in their city, which means that an independent lecture or entertainment of any kind, no matter how meritorious, is boycotted by the local committee in every city in the union of from 2,500 to 40,000 people. Again, it was the same old story. Slocum planned to settle down with Hetty, but it just did not work out. His Eden was much like any other man's, that is, soon lost. Throughout the winter of 1902-3, the West Tisbury correspondent of the Vineyard Gazette reported him in Boston, Washington, New York, North Carolina. There were rumours that the spray might be shown at the St. Louis Fair, and even that the captain would return to Australia. Neither came to pass, of course. In 10 years with the spray, Slocum had managed to work himself out of debt. At last he and Hetty had a house of their own. And for a moment, fortune's tracing appeared to be levelling off and even moving up. But actually, the direction had not changed at all. The captain still was living without central purpose. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.